of a text that I'd like to read out of the 17th chapter of Alma this evening, beginning on page 437. This is part of Alma's instruction to his son Helaman. It begins with a commandment, and then he gives him some counsel and tells him things that we need to know, things that we need to understand about God, about ourselves, our own lack and limitations. Sometimes I read these and I wonder if they were thinking as much about me as they were about themselves when they wrote. Verse 31 of the 17th chapter. And now, my son Helaman, I command you that you take the records which have been entrusted with me, and I also command you that you keep a record of this people, according as I have done upon the plates of Nephi, and keep all these things sacred which I have kept, even as I have kept them, for it is for a wise purpose that they are kept. And these plates of brass which contain these engravings, which have the records of the Holy Scriptures upon them, which have the genealogy of our forefathers even from the beginning. And behold, it has been prophesied by our fathers that they should be kept and handed down from one generation to another, and be kept and preserved by the hand of the Lord until they should go forth unto every nation, kindred, tongue, and people, that they shall know of the mysteries contained thereon. And now behold, if they are kept, they must retain their brightness. Yea, and they will retain their brightness. Yea, and also shall all the plates which do contain that which is holy writ. Now you may suppose that this is foolishness in me, but behold, I say unto you that by small and simple things are great things brought to pass, and by small means in many instances, and small means in many instances doth confound the wise. And the Lord God doth work by means to bring about his great and eternal purposes, and by very small means the Lord doth confound the wise, and bringeth about the salvation of many souls. And now it hath hitherto been wisdom in God that these things should be preserved. For behold, they have enlarged the memory of this people, and convinced many of the error of their ways, and brought them to the knowledge of their God unto the salvation of their souls. Yea, I say unto you, were it not for these things that these records do contain, which are on these plates, Ammon and his brethren could not have convinced so many thousands of the Lamanites of the incorrect tradition of their fathers. Yea, these records and their words brought them unto repentance. That is, they brought them to the knowledge of the Lord their God, and to rejoice in Jesus Christ their Redeemer. And who knoweth but what they will be the means of bringing many thousands of them, yea, and also many thousands of our stiff-necked brethren, the Nephites, who are now hardening their hearts in sins and iniquities, to the knowledge of their Redeemer. Now these mysteries are not yet fully made known unto me. Therefore I shall forbear. And it may suffice if I only say, they are preserved for a wise purpose, which purpose is known unto God. For he doth counsel in wisdom over all his works, and his paths are straight, and his course one eternal round. You and I know of Alma, of his life, of his conversion from the wrongful way of life that he pursued. We know a great deal about him, and of the great amount of good that he was able to do in his life, and of the counsel that has been preserved for you and me from his experience in his life. And I think we'd call Alma a person mighty in spirit, because the Lord had visited him in many ways, and had instructed him, had blessed him, had delivered him, he'd been tried and he'd been proved. And by that trying and proving had been tempered and toughened to become a person of great faith. And he'd received gifts and revelations. And after all this, and living a long and fruitful life, he told his son, "There are a lot of things I don't know." He admitted that he simply did not understand a lot of the things that had been written and preserved. He didn't know what they were or what the purpose of their preservation was. But he said something that is of extreme value to you and me. He said, "I trust and I believe that these things are so preserved for a wise purpose in God." If we back up a little into the early part of this reading, he said that it was prophesied by their fathers that these things should be kept, and they were commanded in prophecy to keep them, even as he commanded his son Helaman, that he should keep them and that they should be precious to him, and that he allow nothing to happen which would harm or destroy them, because it was necessary that they should keep their brightness, because they did contain what was holy in the sight of God. And and that they might be, though the incidents of his life he considered small. And you and I think upon our own lives, and there aren't very many things that are very outstanding in our lives. Nearly everything that happens is a small thing in a succession of small things. And Alma assured his son, and he said, "By these small occurrences, it pleases the Lord to bring about great things." We need to believe that. We need to accept it at its face value and cling to it, because sometimes we're going to find that that's nearly all we have to cling to. But I'd like to leave Alma there for a little bit. Let us think some upon that. But there's another person that's just about as well known to us, and the experience with him was not quite on that plane, but from the same source and the work accomplished is the same. From Acts, the 8th chapter, I want to read concerning a man named Philip, whom we know of well, and how he was by the Spirit in a certain place and was instructed to go and address himself to a man who was reading the scripture, and then he was given opportunity to instruct him in it. That is the Ethiopian eunuch who was riding along in the chariot. And I want to read from beginning at verse 36 in the 8th chapter of Acts. "And as they went on their way, they came unto a certain water. And the eunuch said, 'See, here is water. What doth hinder me to be baptized?' And Philip said, 'If thou believest with all thine heart, thou mayest.' And he answered and said, 'I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God.' And he commanded the chariot to stand still, and they went down both into the water, both Philip and the eunuch, and he baptized him." This man believed also. And that was the message that Alma had to heal him. Besides the specific commands to be obedient, he said, "Believe." And now the Ethiopian said to Philip, "I believe." Now he was at what the business world likes to call today the entry level. He was at the very beginning of what Alma was was far advanced in, and also Helaman, the son of Alma, was very far advanced. But the Ethiopian was at the very rock-bottom beginning. And all he had to believe was that Philip had taught him the gospel correctly, that it did testify of the truth of Christ, and that Christ was the one that it testified of. And that prepared him to believe the other things that he was going to have to learn. And so it is with you and me. The things that we begin with prepare us to believe the things we have to learn. So the child, the newcomer to the gospel, he doesn't have to know an awful lot. The oldster who is acquainted and has the gospel available to him, he may have far greater responsibilities before he comes into the church. But not the beginner. Not the youth. Not the child. Too often we find ourselves, I believe, too near the entry level. Too often we blunder along through our lives and find that our faith hasn't advanced very far past what this man exercised here and evidenced that day. We believe. And we do believe. And we should take comfort in that thought and that understanding. It should not pale for us. But it needs to grow. You remember the incident when the man brought his son to Jesus, and he said, "My son's a lunatic, and he has a dumb spirit that treats him evilly and tears him and throws him about and causes all sorts of things to occur, and I took him to your disciples, and they weren't able to do anything for him." So he asked the Lord, he pled with him and asked him if he would heal this child. I want to read a part of this incident. It's in the 9th chapter of Mark, and I'm going to read from verse 21. And he asked his father, "How long is it ago since this came unto him?" And he said, "Of a child. And oft times it hath cast him into the fire and into the waters to destroy him. But if thou canst do anything, have compassion on us and help us." Jesus said unto him, "If thou canst believe, all things are possible to him that believeth." And straightway the father of the child cried out and said with tears, "Lord, I believe. Help thou mine unbelief." And then the Lord did cast the spirit out of the child and left him there as dead, and the Lord raised him up and restored him to his father. But this condition that the father confessed there before the Lord is probably about the condition that we often find ourselves in. We want to believe, and we do believe, but yet we lack. We lack faith. We lack belief. We know that we need it. We know that we need to believe more wholeheartedly in the Lord, that we need to be able to submit ourselves more fully to Him to gain the help and the guidance that we need from one day to another. And we don't quite understand the mechanics of arriving there. And so I find myself in about the same shape as Alma. I don't really quite understand all I need to know. I see this trait in other people, and I see it in myself. I recognize the lack and know what should be there. But to be able to prescribe for someone else just what moves you should make to gain it, often I don't know. And when I see that I lack in myself, often I don't know what moves to make to gain what I lack. I suppose that the most painful that this is is the times that my children ask me, and this happens more now than it did not very long ago, when they need counsel and need help and guidance, and they say, just how do I get there? Because I admonish them to trust in the Lord and seek the Lord with diligence in order to gain the relief and the help that they need. And they ask, how can I get more than I have? They don't always know. But I believe very firmly that we need to learn it. And when we do, I believe that it'll carry this submission that I mentioned along with it in a very considerable measure. I think we all appreciate the example that the Lord set, because it's probably the finest example that we have. At the time that he prayed in the garden, just before his crucifixion, in 26th chapter of Matthew, and because of the weight of the burden that was on him, he prayed to the Lord. I'm going to read from the 39th verse. And he went a little farther and fell on his face and prayed, saying, O my Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as thou wilt. Now that is the perfect example, because of all the travail he'd already been through, and the labor, and some of it not very rewarding personally, he had come to this pass where his life was required, and his mortal frame shrank from it, because he was mortal. And though it appealed to the mortal to escape it, he said, nevertheless, thy will be done. There's our example. Now, if we pass over it quickly enough, it looks pretty easy, but it's not that easy to acquire. And for most of it, it may take a lot of lumps and hard knocks yet, because it appears that most of us learn most of what we learn by our experience. We don't learn nearly as much by other people's counsel and experience as we might. And then there are things that other people can't counsel us in. There are things that our acquaintances don't have experience in that face us. And nobody knows how to deal with them but God. And we learn both by our seeking him and by the times that we rub our sore places. But as the day that we live in advances, and the experiences that we have because of it, and the difficulties that arrive, we will learn. That I'm very sure of. If we keep our thoughts and our desires directed in the way that they ought to be, the experience, while some of it will be very expensive, it'll all be to our profit and our eventual salvation. I want to read in connection with this thought from the 12th chapter of Daniel. You know, so I'm reading pretty familiar scriptures. And I don't think I'm applying them in any new or radically different way, but rather possibly reminding us of things that we already know. And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which standeth for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation, even unto that same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book. And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever. But thou, Daniel, shut up the book, the words, and seal the book, even to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. He promises us trouble. And I think we pretty well agree that we're seeing the beginning of that, that we're seeing the increase of trouble in the world, and it's touching our lives. Though we're not to this day that he speaks of, because he's speaking of the day of the end. But we're coming close. And the trouble is on the increase. And sometimes it'd be easy to just say, well, if all I've got to look forward to is more trouble, why not just jump off the bridge? Why endure it? Why fight it? Well, I think he gave us some reasons here. He says the wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament. He promises a richness in this time that goes beyond what you and I can grasp, beyond what Daniel could describe. But he saw it. And it was wonderful to behold. And it reminds me of a dream that one of our people recounted here, I think in this room several years ago, not a member of our local, of having a dream where it was in the time of the end, and all of the disorder in the world was coming to its climax, the warfare and whatever. And here was a group of people under a shelter, similar to a toadstool, as I got the picture in my mind, where they were protected from all this. And one of those who was so favored with this protection was exultant and said, what a marvelous time this is to be alive. Because here was visible to all mankind, before the eyes of the believer and the unbeliever alike, the vindication of all the things that we believed up until now. Here the Lord's word was being proved true, and the people who had believed it and practiced it and been scorned and mocked and had suffered ill at the hands of the world because of it were standing and experiencing the reward of it. And it was a marvelous day. He said also knowledge would increase. And we've observed that. And the increase of knowledge has not all been evil. It has improved the quality of our lives, yours and mine. We have a lot of things that make our lives easier than most of us can remember. Not very long ago. And these things are to be accepted, I think, with thanksgiving, and not to place our hearts upon them to the point that we couldn't live without them if we had to. But there is also a great deal of joy and satisfaction to be had in obedience to the Lord, in acts of charity, such as we were admonished to this morning. Personal pleasure and satisfaction that, and this sort of talk goes completely beyond those who don't experience it, because it doesn't make sense. I talk to people like that. I talk to them often, and it makes no sense to them whatsoever. They have no idea what I'm talking about. But it's it makes me think of the old Blue Hudson I used to have, that not very many of you ever saw. But it was kind of a standard joke of mine concerning that old car, that the rare times that it worked right, it was so nice, it was worth all the difficulty that I put up with to get it to that point. And so it is to me with this idea of the rewards of doing good. Sometimes it's more difficult than we can endure, nearly. And we see nothing but discouragement and distress on the way. But when the brightness comes, when the thing that Daniel said here comes to us, and it comes from time to time, we don't have to wait until then to experience any of this. It's so nice that it's worth much more than whatever difficulty we suffered trying to get there. But then there's the other side. The fact is that many do and many will jump off the bridge. Many people who don't have the strength of spirit and character, who don't have the faith, whatever it is. And you and I know right now, people who are fearful and unbelieving, and who are apprehensive about the day that we live in, almost terror struck. Now this I hear in everyday conversation. I don't have to imagine any at all to put this together. Wondering what is going to become of us. What's going to become of the world? What's the trend of the nations clear down to our own livelihood? And this is a heavy, nagging weight of fear. This isn't just a casual wondering and then letting it pass. Well, you and I should view these days with very real concern. Because we care. We care both about ourselves and those that are near and dear to us, and we care or should care about everybody. But we should not be tormented in our minds. We should not be panic struck. We have been forewarned of this day, and warned to some very considerable extent. And this is another thing that the Lord has assured us of, that He would tell us and help us to prepare for what comes, even as He told His own disciples concerning His death and the travail that would come upon them at that time. And so I want to read just a little from the 14th chapter of John, where He reassured them of this. He was telling them concerning that event, and it was immediately before it. And now I have told you before it came to pass, I'm reading from the 29th verse, that when it is come to pass, you might believe. And so it is, the things that we have to know, and a lot of the things that we don't yet understand even, the Lord has told us, so that when it does come to pass, we'll believe, we'll grasp it, we'll say, these are the things that the Lord has warned us of. So that we wouldn't be taken by surprise, because the rest of the world is taken by surprise, because they couldn't see the trends of the history of the world. Now my awareness of these things is not nearly as long as some of you, but I think that I've been fairly aware of these trends since not too long after the end of World War II. Maybe 1947 or 48, I could see, because of the things I was being taught, how the world was inclining itself away from God, how this nation was turning away from the principles that it was established upon, and was not making itself worthy to receive of God what it had shortly before received. And the Lord said, when you see, you'll remember that I told you, and you'll believe. And I'm sure that if we're careful and prayerful, that a lot of things now in prophecy that are so vague that we have no notion what they're saying, that we'll see that the words were rather specific, so literal that we pass them over. And we'll see and we'll believe. But because of the fear that's in the world today. The world compounds its fear and makes it more difficult for itself. For instance, I'm sure that nearly everyone here has been frustrated lately in trying to shop for the things that you want to give as Christmas gifts. Because it seems that a lot of the things that you would like to buy, you simply can't locate because nobody has them. And in my line of work, this has been the case for increasingly so for the last 8 or 10 years. But I'd say since, maybe 6 years ago or seven, when we had quite a steel strike, then businesses became afraid to stock much of a stockpile of goods. They simply would not keep things on hand because they were afraid this whole thing is going to blow up, and here I'll be with all my money tied up in stock I can't sell. And so they wouldn't stock it. And so when they had a sale for it, they didn't have it. So they have to run and hunt, and the price goes up. Phone calls all over the world. Unnecessary delays for the customer who needs what he wanted to buy, because his livelihood depends on it, and the livelihood of his employees. And so it runs pell-mell over itself. And the world hurts its own commerce out of fear. There were things that we used to buy for our plant. Repair parts, large, expensive repair parts, that a manufacturer would only keep a few on hand because they were so large and expensive. Now they don't keep any. So if we have to order one, it may take a year to get it. They don't even have the material to build it out of because they're afraid that they'll get left holding the bag, as we say, because they're afraid. And so now we build ourselves a lot of things that it wasn't feasible not very long ago to build. If we wait the year for the manufacturer, it costs three times what it should because he has to build one by hand rather than have his automatic equipment set up to make 100 or so. And if we have to build it, it costs 10 times as much. And somebody has to pay. And this is all the result of fear, of lack of faith. That's what fear is. It's lack of faith. You know, we're all frightened at times. If we're wise, we're frightened fairly often. There are a lot of things that we just have a healthy respect for that comes to fear. But this is not what the Lord was talking about when he said that the fearful and unbelieving and those, let me read it for you in the Revelation, the 21st chapter. But the fearful and unbelieving and the abominable and murderers and whoremongers and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burneth with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. I believe that he's talking about those who either had no faith or what faith they had they abandoned and ran before this fear that exists throughout the world and did not exercise faith to trust God for help and for guidance and for deliverance. Didn't believe that he could. You know, we shake our heads. We think about people who become lost in the woods. And they run, and they exhaust themselves. They get all hot and bothered and throw their coat away, and throw their rifle away, and throw whatever else they might have that they're going to need desperately as soon as they're tired enough to stop. But they throw it away. And yet, throughout the world, because fear rules people's minds. They throw away what could save them. They trust in God. You know, it's a mistake for us to demand of ourselves that we understand everything that transpires, that we understand the significance of every event of history, that we be able to explain every passage of Scripture that we read. If we demand of ourselves that we fully understand all of this, first thing we know, we'd be trying to imagine explanations, and we get ourselves in hot water. And I think we know the names of people who've done that. A lot of what occurs in the world, apparently there isn't any reason for. But I'd like to call you back, your attention back to Alma. He knew there was a reason, and he knew it was good. But he didn't always know what it was. I think that needs to be something that we consider very well, frequently, for ourselves. That we know that God's reasoning is sound, that whatever he does suits a wise purpose in his mind in the bringing about of the history of the world. But sometimes accept the fact that we just don't know what it is, but trust him. Probably as true a thought as there is to me in that respect is in Paul's letter to the Romans. I can locate Romans here. I'll just read it for you in the 9th chapter. Verse 29. Then, as Isaiah said before, except the Lord of Sabbath had left us a seed, we had been as Sodom, and has been made like unto Gomorrah. In the book of Isaiah, it says a remnant. Except the Lord had left us something to cling to and be what will bring on a more fruitful time, a seed to sustain us and bring about the growth that's necessary, we would have become a Sodom. Now, he was speaking of the nation of Israel at that time, but it's a sound for us, I think, as it was for them. Because he knew that they would have wandered away. Without something to cling to, they would have gone as far as men could wander from God. If we had nothing to cling to, we'd be as bad off as the people that I've spoken of who are so obsessed with the fears of the day that they complicate their life to the point that they can barely survive it. What say we then? That the Gentiles, which followed not after righteousness, have attained to righteousness, even the righteousness which is of faith. But Israel, which followed after the law of righteousness, hath not attained to the law of righteousness. Wherefore? Because they sought it not by faith, but as it were by the works of the law. For they stumbled at that stumbling stone, as it is written, Behold, I lay in Zion a stumbling stone, and a rock of offense, and whosoever believeth on him shall not be ashamed. Because Israel didn't exercise faith in the exercise of the law, but only hoped to preserve themselves by ritual, by ceremony. He said if they hadn't had what God provided them to hold them together, they'd have fallen into complete unbelief and disobedience, instead of just being in a rather deplorable state. But he said that the Gentiles, who didn't have this to fall back on, who didn't have the acts of of a physical law, when they believed, the only thing they had to cling to was faith. And because they had that, they attained to righteousness. So people today who trust in empty ceremony stumble over something as simple as faith in Christ and can't manage it. Simply can't manage to rise up and believe. Believe that what he says is true, literally true. When he said, "I won't leave you alone," they don't believe it. And when he says, "This manner, this sort goes not out except by fasting and prayer," they can't grasp it. Can't entertain it as being valuable. Because they've had something else to rely on, and it didn't teach them anything. We've emerged from among the world and didn't have anything else to rely on but God. And so it's not too far-fetched to you and me to believe that God will reach down and intervene in our lives if we ask him to. How or when, we don't always know. As often the things that we think are right for us now don't occur. But a simple faith and a literal belief we have to have. Tradition is not wrong. Just because it's tradition, it doesn't mean that it has to be wrong. If it's founded in something that's right. You know, we have a lot of traditions as a church that are pretty good. One of them is that we gather together on Sunday to teach and be taught and to exercise faith and to admonish each other. I think it's a real sound tradition. But I encounter people who don't. I've encountered people in the Church of Christ who were the very essence of boredom as they sat and labored through the service. Were so tired of it by the time they got there that they could hardly stand it the entire time they stayed. Because it wasn't founded on faith. Read this last in part of this last verse again. And whosoever believeth on him shall not be ashamed. So really the need for our lives is that we strengthen that belief. So that we won't have to be ashamed, but so that the Lord will acknowledge before his Father that we are the ones that he has called his own.